Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And we're live. So hello, everybody around the world, and a special hello to Susan Johnson Taylor, who's back on the show. Welcome back, Susan.
Hi, Mel. Thank you for having me back.
What are you talking about? A year ago, we were talking about a baby that hadn't hatched. And next Tuesday, it's launching.
That's right.
So before you tell us about the launch and your wonderful, colorful book, I have to remind myself to mention that this is the Children's Literature Channel, the New Books Network. And I'm your host, Mel Rosenberg. And Susan, now we can have fun. So tell us all about your beautiful new book.
All right. Officially launching next Tuesday with Gnome Road is Animals in Surprising Shades, Poems About Earth's Colorful Creatures. And this is a STEM poetry collection that celebrates animals in all kinds of unusual shades, from the pink manta ray to the violet snail, the Picasso bug. It goes in rainbow order and it presents different poetic forms and also introduces kids to all kinds of different animals and STEM concepts as well.
Okay. It's also STEAM. STEM also and STEAM.
Yes. STEM and STEAM.
Okay. Tell the people who don't know what the difference is.
All right, so STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math, and STEAM is all of those terms, plus the A is for arts.
Okay, and you have really done a magnificent job here, because this is not only nonfiction for kids, this is a book of poetry, and not only that, different kinds of poetry. Let's start out. Show the people who can watch. The rest of you who are listening to the podcast are going to have to run out and buy this book. It's gorgeous. It's poetry. Show us, Susan.
Thank you.
And talk a little bit about the illustrator.
Sure. The illustrator is Annie Baxt, and she just did a beautiful job with the colors and the textures and the different creatures and habitats. So each spread presents a different animal and a different poetic form, and that is my way of celebrating the biodiversity found in our world. So all different kinds of animals in different colors, shapes, sizes, species, and they all make our world more vibrant and more beautiful.
Absolutely. And there are other books, I hasten to say, many other books on incredible animals. I hope to have one someday, but I've never seen one in which the poetry and the importance of poetry runs alongside the amazingness of the animals. Read us a poem and show us, and then you have the little sidebars on what kind of poem it is.
Sure.
It's incredible.
All right, I'm going to read the very first poem, which is called Animals in Surprising Shades. And this is sort of a call to action for kids to explore the book and explore the animals found in our world. So it starts, "Ever seen a purple snail, a spotted newt with orange tail? If you'd like to take a look, please turn the pages of this book. For nature's full of brilliant hues, vivid pinks to navy blues, come marvel at the painted bugs, speckled frogs, and ruffled slugs.
Wonderful. And can you read us another one? What kind of meter is that?
So this is, this poetic form is an octave, which is an eight line poem, which is kind of like the eight limbs of an octopus. So I thought that was a fun way to open the book. And let me find another poem.
Or the eight notes of a scale.
There you go. Exactly. Bringing it back to music. I love that. All right. So this poem is a quatrain, which is a four line poem, and it's all about the blue-footed booby, which is fun to say. No candy hearts or rose bouquets, no string quartets or moonlit gaze. For ladies seeking true romance, it's all about his clumsy dance. And that is because...
This is the one with the blue shoes.
Yep, exactly.
Can you show everybody? I love this.
Yeah.
They're not shoes, they're actually his feet, but...
Right. So the male blue-footed boobies do a funny little courtship dance, and that's how they attract their mates. So that's why the poem talks about his clumsy dance and how male blue-footed boobies, they don't woo with roses or candy hearts or moonlight walks like some humans do. It's all about doing their silly little dance. And that's also how they got their name because, let's see, it's based on the Spanish word bobo, meaning silly or foolish. And European explorers gave them their name because of their funny little dance.
Okay, but you know what I'm reminded of? Because we are both musicians, and we'll get to that later, is I think it was Fats Waller that has the song Your Feet's Too Big.
I think you're right.
Right down in Harlem at a table for two, there were four of us, honey, me or Big Feet and you. So I'm thinking that given the fact that you're a singer and a musician and you're out of Austin, right? Mm-hmm. And there are so many talented musicians in Austin, you should find somebody to put your book to music. And then you can sing the poems when you do the school visits. Oh my goodness.
Oh, that would be fun.
If you don't find somebody, I will write the music.
Well, I do have someone in mind for that. And one of the activities that I'm going to do at my launch party and that hopefully I'll do at school visits is someone suggested to me that for kinesthetic learners, people who learn kind of hands-on in action, we'll do a little motion for each poem, and that way they can feel the poetry in their bodies and see it in motion. So for instance, that first poem that I read, we could be looking left and right and exploring. We could do a funny little dance for the blue-footed boobies. I think that's going to be really fun.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but you can find somebody to put it to music. It's not mutually exclusive.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love that idea.
The blue-footed boobies with the joy. Somebody's written that. Okay, so tell us, because last time you were on, you talked a little bit about your youth and your childhood, but we didn't talk about your love for poetry and your penchant to be a poetess in so many different formats.
Yeah, so I don't have it handy, but when I was helping my mom clean out some old pictures and documents at her condo, we came across a picture that I'd probably drawn maybe in third or fourth grade. And it said something like, my greatest wish is to become an author and a poet. And I saw that and I was like, oh, little Susan, it's happening. I remember maybe when I was in third or fourth grade, we had like a show and tell night where people would bring in collections like rock collections and troll doll collections because it was the 90s. And I sat at a little table. I had printed out several of my poems and mounted them on construction paper. And I sat at my table and I had my poems for show and tell. I think I've always loved to read, and I've always been fascinated by language. So, and also the rhythm of language and music. So I think it was a natural fit for me. I've always been drawn to that.
Okay, but you don't always write in rhyme. I've seen others of your stories.
Right, yeah. I also write in prose too.
So can you open this wonderful book and read us another poem in another style?
Sure. Let's see. Okay. This is a poem.
Yes, that's my favorite one.
Oh, and you know, that's a lot of people's favorite poem. In fact, of the poems that I wrote in my first draft, this is one of the few surviving poems. A lot of these poems have gone through many iterations, and I've tossed out poems and written new poems, but this is one of the surviving poems from the very first version of this book. So this, in case you didn't get a good look at it, is a concrete poem, which is a poem that takes the shape of its subject, in this case, a pink manta ray. And as far as we know, there's only one pink manta ray in the entire world, which makes it very special. It is 11 feet, and it was spotted off the coast of Australia. And scientists believe that its unusual coloring may be caused by a condition called erythmicism, and that makes the skin appear pink or red. So it's very unusual and one of a kind. So this poem says, "In a sea of teal, a blink of pink, fins flutter, graceful as a ballerina and strong like a blue whale, somersaulting between coral reefs. As fish nibble on his skin, the gentle giant breaths. Once clean, he darts off to a new adventure."
And can you show everybody again? It's in the form of a manta ray. Mm-hmm. It's just brilliant.
Thank you. And then the little curvy tail is the word adventure.
It's great.
Thank you.
So, Susan, this is the beginning of what I hope is going to be a very, very illustrious career as an original children's author. But you have written about 12 other children's books, work for hire.
That's right.
I've never seen them. You're not proud of them?
No, I have. Let's see. I have some on the shelf right here.
Of course
this
you do.
Is The Dog Who Changed History, which is about Alexander Graham Bell's dog, Truth. And this dog really did exist. We have no proof that the dog influenced Alexander's invention of the telephone. But this is a fun kind of historical fiction imagining of how Truth might have been involved. Kind of like if you know Ben and Me, that's about Ben and his pet mouse, Amos. The publisher came to me and wanted a Ben and Me type story, but with a different inventor and a different pet. So that's this book. And then my very first work for hire book is Ride Across Time, which is a historical fiction graphic novel book. And this is about the American Revolutionary heroine, Sybil Ludington, who actually rode further than Paul Revere. And she was just a teenager. So her story isn't as well known, but I thought it would be fun to introduce her to young readers.
That's wonderful. So you've had success in this, and actually you're one of the interviewees on this podcast, videocast, who make a living writing.
That's right.
So you sit all day and write.
I have a treadmill desk, like? So I'm not sitting.
Now, what does your day look like? I mean, you are, so you work for companies, you write content, you write books for hire, you write your own manuscripts, which are fantastic. And you're a musician, singer, thespian, How does your time, how do you divide your time?
Well, it really depends on the day. Like this week and obviously next week, I'm doing a lot of promotions for the book, which is very exciting. I'm also working on a writing project for an ed tech company, teaching parts of speech and grammatical concepts to third graders, which is really cool and fun. And yeah, I have some other projects writing for adults. So it's just a matter of, you know, figuring out what are the deliverables that I need to get done this week, and then fitting in blog and podcast interviews and drafting new manuscripts and social media promotions and all of that.
And then the singing.
And the singing, yes.
So you're a busy, busy lady. So last time we talked on the show, we talked about Susan as an 8-year-old or 9-year-old. That seems to be your sweet spot. Is there any particular reason that you can remember? Was this a year in your life that you were very happy, very sad? You know, I'm always interested in how we get stuck with our 5-year-olds or 8-year-olds. I'm stuck with my 5-year-old, and you're stuck with 8 or 9, 8-year-old Susan. And actually, you kind of alluded to it, you know, when you went back in time, like your book, and said, hey, 8-year-old Susan, who wrote that in her diary or whatever, look, we have a book.
Yeah. So that would have been around third or fourth grade. And fourth grade was a big deal for me, because in my elementary school, I went to Lilja Elementary School in Natick, Massachusetts, and that went kindergarten through fourth grade. So the fourth graders were like the big kids on campus. So you got to do the fourth grade play, and the fourth graders did a business unit. And so we made jewelry and sold jewelry so that we could learn about entrepreneurship. And so I think that, like, in my mind, leading up to fourth grade, that was like, wow, that's really like, that's going to be my year. And that's like a big deal. I get to do all these big kid things before I move on to middle school. And of course, so I get to fourth grade, I get to do all those fun things like the fourth grade play and the business unit and all that, all those fun activities that I had watched other kids do for several years. And then that summer, we moved for my dad's job. We moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico. And then suddenly, I wasn't going into middle school like I thought. I had kind of like a bonus elementary school year. It was fifth grade were the big kids on campus at the elementary school. So it's a little anticlimactic, because all of fourth grade you hear about next year you're going to middle school and it's such a big deal. But I think that, like, for a long time in elementary school, I had built up like fourth grade is like the year. It's so big and important, and you're the big kids in the school, and you're a role model for the younger kids. And I just had so much anticipation for that year.
And you had another year instead, as it were.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Okay. So now the other important question is, you are one of the 1,000 or one of the 5,000, who's counting, authors who have a children's book out, a picture book out with a traditional press. And how did this great fortune, not that you don't deserve it, but you do, but how did this happen?
Yeah, so I had been submitting to agents, and I was fortunate enough to get a revise and resubmit. Which means that they see potential in the work, but they want you to do some revisions and send it back to them. And the feedback that I got was that this agent loved the Pink Manta Ray poem, like you do, but she wanted the other poems to deliver that same level of surprise and wonder. So I stopped submitting that project, and I took several months to really like reevaluate each poem. I discarded a lot of poems. I changed the animals that I was featuring so that they could deliver as much surprise and wonder as possible. And I got a critique at an SCBWI conference. And then in the fall, I sent it back to that agent and I sent it to some other agents. And the feedback was that they all loved the writing, but they just weren't sure about selling another poetry collection. Because as you mentioned, there are a ton of children's poetry collections on the market. I feel like about half of them are written by Jane Yolen because she is a legend. And I use some of her books as mentor texts for my project. But I really believed in the work and my critique partners really believed in the work. So they told me, you know, even if you don't get an agent, like you have got to, this has to be a book. So I said at the end of 2020, I said, you know, if I still don't have an agent in January, I'm going to start submitting this directly to editors because I really believe that this book has potential. So that's exactly what I did. And I saw that Gnome Road was a brand new publisher and their manuscript wish list mentioned that they were, among other things, you know, the list is very eclectic, fiction, nonfiction, rhyme, prose. And one of the things that the editor, Sandra Sutter, was looking for was lyrical texts, exploring nature, steam texts, poetry. And I said, well, I have all of those things in this project. So I sent it to her in March of 2021. They're only open certain times of the year. They have open submission periods rather than being open all the time, because otherwise they would just get inundated with submissions. So during that open submission period in March of 2021, I sent it to her and she liked the project. She wanted to know if I had more of these poems. And of course I did, because I had written more poems and some of them I hadn't included in the final manuscript that I submitted. So I sent her additional poems. She loved them. She wanted to talk on Zoom. And as soon as we hopped on Zoom, I could just tell that she shared my vision and my passion for this project. She asked, what type of art do you think would pair well with this? What's your vision for the illustrations? And I said, I want it to feel like fine art, like something you could hang on your wall, not cartoony, not with those black outlines that make it very cartoony. I said, I just really want the art to be beautiful and I want the colors to really pop off the page, but it has to also be kid friendly. Not everything that's hanging in a museum is going to appeal to a kid, right? It can be beautiful, but it might not have that kid appeal. So I said, those are the two things that I want. And I felt like she agreed with me. She validated, you know, that vision. And we also found Annie Bax could really execute on that vision. I mean, I think her use of color is just beautiful. Oh,
she's incredible. One second. Who found her?
I actually found her, I think maybe on Instagram. And I sent Sandra, you know, a couple of different names of illustrators that I had seen on Instagram that I really liked their style. And I also was specifically looking for illustrators who had examples of animals, obviously, because that's very important. There's no people.
Susan, do you realize that this is very rare, because usually editors just pick their illustrators?
Right.
You never meet them. You just get the artwork.
Well, I think that's the benefit of, in some cases, working at a smaller press, that they really want, especially because it's my debut, I felt like Sandra really wanted it to be a book that we could both be proud of. So she did ask for my input, and I really felt like that input was heard.
Well, that's marvelous. Well, as you know, I have my debut book coming out next month.
Congratulations.
And, thank you. And my editor, really didn't ask me. He sort of asked me, but there was only one answer, and that was yes. But lucky, he's just phoned now. But lucky for me, he picked a wonderful illustrator. But oftentimes, even if you pick the illustrator, okay, you still, you know, you're giving your baby up for adoption twice, right? You're giving it up to the editor, and there's going to be all kinds of changes, and you have to do them, and maybe it's not your vision. And then you pick the illustrator and you get the artwork for your book. How did it feel when you saw the pictures?
It was even more beautiful than I had pictured. It was so exciting to see these animals brought to life.
Were you trepidating?
No, I was just really excited because I felt like we had picked the right illustrator who could execute on what I was hoping she would do. And I also saw that Annie had a number of examples of animals on her Instagram. There's no humans in my book, so it was really important that the illustrator be able to illustrate animals in a beautiful, naturalistic, but also kid-friendly way, and to portray the motion. And I felt like she did that beautifully.
Okay, so you are one of the authors I've interviewed over 80. You are one of the few who had a traditional publishing deal without an agent. And that's incredible. So it can be done. It can be done. But I don't want people to misunderstand and think that you didn't have the right stuff when you approached. You've been practicing for years. So what did the practice entail? What do you tell young or old aspiring authors on their way to becoming the one in 1,000?
So much practice. And I think that because when I started on this kidlit journey, I had already been writing professionally for adults for almost 10 years. And so I kind of underestimated the learning curve that was involved, because writing for kids is so different from writing for adults. When you're writing for adults, you don't have to think about using kid-friendly language. You don't have to think about leaving room for the illustrator. It is so different. And I think I underestimated that initially. But now I've really immersed myself in the market. I have read and studied over 2,500 picture books. I keep track on Goodreads. And I also segment my Goodreads books into different shelves, like first person point of view, second person point of view, historical fiction, nonfiction, poetry. So whenever critique partners ask for mentor texts, like, tell me about picture books written in the second person, I have like a long list of books that I can share with them. And that's useful for me too, when I'm thinking about new projects and what are the books that I can look to as mentor texts. I've also taken a number of classes at the Writing Barn here in Austin, and they are available to a lesser extent now in person, but it used to be a lot of in-person classes before the pandemic. It's also very active online. I'm now a Writing Barn Fellow, so I TA for other instructors. And then next month, I'll be teaching my first Writing Barn class. So I'm really excited about that.
Okay, I want to be in that class. Oh, it'll probably be 4 a.m.
I don't, it's 2:00 Central Time. So I don't know what that is for, I don't know what that is.
2:00 Central Time is about 4 a.m.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's an ungodly hour.
Yeah.
I don't think God has ungodly hours, but human beings do.
For sure. I agree.
So that's wonderful advice. I'm going to ask you now to read yet another poem from your gorgeous book.
Okay. Any requests?
No, I just, each poem has a different poetry form. I want you to read the sidebar also. It explains the form of the poetry. So, I mean, this is really what I teach my students, you know, thinking between boxes. You know, science and art are much the same thing. And you've brought them together. I love it. I think you're wonderful.
Thank you. All right.
One of my favorite kidlit people is you, Susan.
Oh, thank you, Mel. I just love the colors in this illustration. This is the poem about the violet snail. And so this poetic
form. Show us the snail. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So this poetic form is a persona. And a persona is a poem that uses a speaker or narrator who is clearly not the poet, in this case, a snail. And this poem rhymes, but personas do not have to rhyme. So it says, I sail upon a sudsy raft, a work of mollusk handicraft. My ombre shell's a smart disguise to help me blend with seas and skies. When hungry birds fly overhead, they dine on other foods instead. As schools of fish lurk underneath, I drift away from fearsome teeth.
It's brilliant. And okay, there's classes of aquatic and also avian animals that that have like camouflage above and camouflage below, and this is one of them. So I'm going to have a one of the greatest proponents of nonfiction on the show in a few weeks, Melissa Edwards. What do you think about this argument? You know, there's an argument that there's too many fiction picture books, not enough nonfiction picture books. And I know that you write beautiful fiction, but your success has come with a nonfiction book. What is your opinion on this, Susan?
Well, so interestingly, all but one of my work for hires are fiction. They're all historical fiction, which, by the way, any editors listening, I love writing historical fiction. I love it. I think when the editor approached me about, would you be interested in writing historical fiction? I think she was thinking that I would maybe say yes reluctantly, but my reaction was yes, because I grew up with reading all the American Girl books. I still have some of them on my shelf. So I just think that books are a wonderful way to get kids excited about history, and particularly when there's a young protagonist. That's a great way to bring history to life for kids. But the argument about fiction versus nonfiction, I think that both are necessary. We need both on our shelves. Kids should be reading both. You know, some kids have a natural inclination to want to read more fiction or more nonfiction. But I think we need both in our worlds, and we should be reading both. And in fact, there's two authors here in Austin, Lindsay Leslie and Kari Lavelle, who do joint author visits to schools. And one of them, Lindsay writes fiction and Kari writes nonfiction. And so they do a really fun like face off of fiction versus nonfiction. And I've seen pictures and it just looks so fun. So I think we need both of them on our shelves. I think that tradition in the past, nonfiction has gotten a reputation for being kind of dry and boring and textbooky. And you know, authors like Melissa Stewart have proved that you can write nonfiction in really fun and engaging ways. I hope that my book does that.
Melissa Stewart, did I say that she would be on the show in 3 weeks? She will.
Great. That's amazing. She's such a luminary, and she's a master of nonfiction picture books.
Okay. And Susan, so we are coming close to the wonderful surprise. And one of the things that brings us together is your love of music. Because you sing so much better than I do, let's end the show with a song. And you've actually picked a song that's related to your new book. So before you sing the song, Animals in Surprising Shades by Susan Johnson Taylor, launching on Tuesday, but you can buy it already, and you should, because it's beautiful and it introduces children to the wonderful world of nature and incredibly colored animals. The artwork is gorgeous. The poems are delectable. Is there a word, delectable?
Yeah. Yes.
What does it mean?
Kind of, it's a synonym for delicious. It's just really irresistible.
Absolutely. And so what song did you decide to sing, as if I didn't know?
So one of the themes of this book is celebrating animals in their many colors. Some of these animals might be unusual, like the pink manta ray is very unusual. But like I said, all of these vibrant animals make our world more beautiful and more vivid. So I chose the Cyndi Lauper song, True Colors, in celebration of that theme.
Go for it, dear.
All right. I see your true colors shining through. I see your true colors, and that's why I love you. So don't be afraid to let them show your true colors. True colors are beautiful like a rainbow.
Woo! This has been a treat. So all of you who, so if you wish, Susan, please add the your website and where people can hire you to write your amazing books and where people can buy your new book, Animals in Surprising Shades. You are one of the truly wonderful people in this business, if it's a business, which it sort of isn't. You help. You have this huge mountain of knowledge, expertise. You're a go-to person. You're always willing to help, to read a manuscript, to give advice, sage advice, I must say. And I can't wait for our next interview, because it will be when you next get a book deal.
Thanks, Mel.
Okay, so my name is Mel Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And I've been talking to the wonderful Susan Johnston Taylor, talking about her brand new book, Animals in Surprising Shades, from Nome Road, which launches on Tuesday. Run out and get it. Susan, it's been wonderful.
Thank you so much, Mel.
Take care, everybody.